You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Nichols on the line with us. He is the author of Uprising and also the Washington correspondent for The Nation, thenation.com. And he's based out of Madison, Wisconsin, where big happenings are going on. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Tom. We've been telling this story for a long time, and it just keeps getting better.
Well, it's getting better now because this video came out. Let me just play this clip. This is Scott Walker and a billionaire donor to his campaign who we can talk about it after the fact, but this was just a few days after he was inaugurated, if I have this right.
Yeah,
okay, here's the clip.
Any chance we'll ever get to be a completely red state and work on these unions?
Oh, yeah.
And become a right to work?
Well, in fact,
what can we do to help you?
Well, we're going to start in a couple of weeks with our budget adjustment bill. The first step is we're going to deal with collective bargaining for all public employee unions.
Right.
Because you divide and conquer.
So let's take out the public employees, in other words, the government employees, and then you divide them from the private employees, that is, the corporate sector employees, and conquer them. Do I have that right?
Exactly. You got it, Tom. And there's more. You know, you're playing the right clip. That's exactly the guts of the thing. But as you look into more of the videotape, the raw footage and transcripts of the discussion, you find that Scott Walker says that busting the public sector unions, quote unquote, opens the door for the next step. And then later on, he says to this woman that his real hero among the governors is Mitch Daniels, although he's jealous of Daniels, because Daniels could wipe out public sector unions with an executive order, whereas Walker has to pass a law.
Right. According to the Wisconsin state constitution, you can't do that if you're governor. You have to actually have the legislature do it.
That's exactly right. But it is important to remember the Mitch Daniels story, especially in the context of this conversation, because Mitch Daniels was elected governor of Indiana after saying publicly that he would not try to pass a right-to-work law. He attacked public sector workers, but said he was only trying to balance budgets, not trying to destroy unions. And yet, in his second term, what did Mitch Daniels do? He helped to pass and then signed a right-to-work law which undermined the private sector unions in his state. So I think we have to ask ourselves, do we believe what Scott Walker says in public, or do we believe what he says to the woman who is his single largest campaign donor?
Right, who has given him over $500,000 now.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, her donation to Scott Walker, and her donations actually came in a couple of increments and began just days after that conversation in the videotape. Her donations to Scott Walker are the largest donations ever to any candidate in the history of Wisconsin.
Wow.
It's also notable that she met with Scott Walker regularly in the aftermath of that conversation. She also found time to fly down to meet with the Koch brothers at their annual conferences in Palm Springs.
Now, I was looking on InTrade this afternoon, and the good news is that they've got Obama beating Romney 67 to 30-something.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is that these are professional bettors all around the world who are fairly politically astute. They're placing, as of a few hours ago when I looked, it changes from minute to minute, but as of a few hours ago, they were placing the reelection of Scott Walker at 71%.
Yeah, I think look, there's a lot of betting that Walker can do this, and I don't think we should be unrealistic, Tom. Scott Walker has raised more than $25 million. He will raise that much again from people like this Diane Hendricks. He additionally has tens of millions coming in, and I cannot emphasize that word, that phrase, tens of millions of dollars coming in from the Koch brothers and the DeVos family that support privatization of education and others. This has become the number one battleground for the right wing in America.
Well, and this is where they're testing all the strategies that they'll use in November.
That's exactly right. This is the first Citizens United election.
Yeah.
And here's an interesting thing. If the right, and if a corporate right prevails, in saving Scott Walker in Wisconsin, I will guarantee you that those betting figures will switch for Barack Obama, because it will become increasingly clear that big money can, in fact, beat people power, and it can even beat the truth. And that's an interesting thing. We've got this videotape now showing Scott Walker specifically talking about dividing and conquering Wisconsin. We also have video of him saying the exact opposite to Congress. The truth of the matter is, he gave deceptive testimony to the Congress of the United States. There's a lot to deal with here. But if progressive forces cannot muster the resources to counter those billions of dollars, well, I should say tens of millions of dollars that Scott Walker will have, then you've got a new Citizens United template, and it's a scary one.
It's basically the corporate ownership of America. I don't know if you saw the piece in today's today's New York Times about WPP.
Yes.
I mean, here you have, this is a British corporation that's buying up all the lobby shops, or most of the lobby shops, the big ones, Hill and Knowlton, you know, Ogilvy and Mather's old government operations deal, the one that was started by Howard Dean that ultimately raised $100 million for Obama. All of them, left, right, Democratic, Republican, doesn't matter. All of them owned by one British company, and 60% in the state of California, they actually did a study. Nobody's, to the best of my knowledge, done a federal study, unless you know off the top of your head. But in the state of California, about 60% of all laws introduced are actually written by lobbyists.
Well, there's no doubt that it's a pattern across the country. And Tom, I've got to tell you that what you're talking about there is smart business. If I had enough money to buy up all the lobbying shops, frankly, to buy up a lot of the other structural supports for a corporate control of elections and governance in America, I'd do it, you know,
sure.
Because I might not do it morally, but just from a business standpoint, yeah, I'd be attracted to the idea. This is the way to make money in the 21st century if we don't push the Citizens United ruling back.
Yeah.
Simple reality is that corporations won't have to be good at what they do. They won't have to come up with new ideas or new products. They'll just have to hire the best lobbyists, and they win no matter what. And having control over the lobbying operations, you know, means that you can pretty much write your ticket.
Well, not only that, this company and many of the companies that they're buying are not just lobbying operations. They also have advertising agencies attached to them. They also have PR firms attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go to, and they have advocacy groups and super PACs attached to them in some cases. And so they can go into a state, they could go into Wisconsin, for example, and, you know, run ads, do their own ads, run ads on behalf of Scott Walker, you know, write the legislation that they want him to do after they save his neck, or his life, or what, politically speaking. And then run the advertising and the PR to get the public to support it. I mean, it's a one-stop program. It's amazing.
You're so right, and it's going to just be, it'll be, if it happens, and I happen to have great faith in people power, I actually think Wisconsin can still go the other way, that the people can win this one. But I will tell you this, if Scott Walker prevails, it'll be like in one of those James Bond films, where the PR, the corporate types will come in, they'll invite powerful political players into a room, and they will say, look at what happened with Scott Walker. He was exposed politically. He was totally threatened. He was facing defeat. And yet, we were able to muster the money. We were able to create the political structures that saved him. We can do this for anyone.
Right.
And when they make that message, whoever's sitting in that room will be more than ready to pony up.
Yeah. And any politician who hears that will either get out of politics or will get with the program. And that's just not good for America. John Nichols, thenation.com. Reed Uprising. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. You're right up the story.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And if you want to put an end to this insanity that was brought to us courtesy of the Supreme Court, go to movetoamend.org.
Scott Walker, the airwaves are full of slick out-of-state ads loaded with bull. Supplied by the orchestrate the swan song of fairness in our badger state. Sure, Scott, sure.
Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Ryan in Hobart, Indiana. Hey, Ryan. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, how's it going, Thomas?
Good.
Pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate everything that you do. Just want to let you know on a little tidbit. A lot of publicity has been going to Governor Walker, especially after seeing that on YouTube yesterday. But Mitch Daniels here in Indiana, he passed a right-to-work law. I'm a member with Local 26 Roofers. And since that passage went through, we have a contract that's up at the end of May here. And that was the first thing that the contractors noted, that they'd like to see us take a 20% pay cut on our next contract.
Yep.
So we're going down to a union meeting tonight. We went for one on last Monday, and out of 178 members that were there, 174 of them wanted to strike. They went ahead and voted for that. So,
but now that
all these guys go ahead.
Well, Ryan, now that Indiana is a right to work for less state, and let's call it by its right name, doesn't that mean that if you guys strike, they can just say, okay, see you later, and we're going to hire scabs?
And essentially, that's what the contractors are pushing for, that the guys that won't cross back through the line. I'm not necessarily sure that that they're coming back through.
Yeah.
A lot of guys are wondering. A lot of guys are afraid. But if we don't stand together, then what do we got?
Yeah. Yeah. It's what Ben Frank.
Yeah, we've definitely been put in a bad spot. It's not necessarily that they're just taking the money that the unions put towards the Democratic Party, which is what everybody knows it's for. It's to it hurts us. It hurts the regular.
Well, it's what Ben Franklin said at the meeting where they signed the Declaration of Independence. He said, you know, if we don't hang together, we will certainly hang separately. And
that's the truth.
Yeah,
One more quick thing about that. Diane Hendricks, she owns the ABC Supply Company, which is the largest distributor of roofing goods. So all our union brothers at Local 11 that listen to WCPT, please don't buy from ABC. She's the one that's funding these right wing Republican governors.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the she owns the biggest supply house of roofing material. We have some power in that aspect that we don't have to buy from them.
That's remarkable. Ryan, thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up on this. And give us a call and let us know how it works out with your union, okay?
Will do.
Okay, thanks. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I'm calling about a fundraising letter I got from Scott Walker.
You're kidding. You're in Virginia.
Yeah, I know. It was dated April the 23rd this year. Yeah. It sort of reminds me back in 2010. I got more campaign literature from Sharon Angle than I did any candidate running in Virginia.
That's really interesting. You have never been registered as a Republican?
No, I'm always a Democrat. Well, Virginia, you don't have a party affiliation.
Are you an NRA member?
No.
Huh. I wonder how you ended up on there. You know, have you ever signed a petition to do anything, you know, legalize pot or whatever?
No.
Okay, because sometimes when you sign these petitions, what you're actually doing is re-registering as a Republican in your voter ID, your voter, you know, as a voter. That's amazing. So Scott Walker's asking for money all over the country is the bottom line.
Yeah, I thought it was only legal up to the petitions were approved or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the laws on fundraising, but it's pretty startling that he's raising money out of state. Tony, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up. I appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, listen, you know, I got to tell you something. As much as the corporations are to blame for a lot of this stuff, I'm from Michigan, and I'm about the same age as you are. I started at Michigan State in 1978. But the whole entire upper Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, have turned into a bunch of knuckleheads. I blame the people of Wisconsin for what's happened to their state, you know, and I'll tell you why.
There's a lot of Republicans there in the rural areas in particular.
Look what's happened to Michigan, too. They all seem to have this culture of I call it horizontal envy, where anybody who's got two more nickels to rub together than you do is the enemy. And they're like, whoa, how did you get that? I don't get that. And they don't care about you know, I have about half of my family are devout Democrats, and even they sound like fools. My mom has been a lifelong Democrat. and a nurse, and she complains about how the nurses' unions are getting. I said, you know, I said, Mom, she says the unions are getting away with murder. She's a Democrat. I said, look, you'd like to have what they have. She said, well, yeah. I said, you know what that means? That means if you had that, you'd be getting away with murder, too. So, you know, this like, well, because somebody else has a little bit more.
This has been the strategy from the very get-go. I mean, this goes back to 1947 when Taft-Hartley was passed, which enabled states to become right to work for less states. And that was divide unionized employers from non-unionized employees by pointing out to the non-unionized employees that they're making less. And positioning that not as a strong reason to join a union, which is what it should be,
right,
but rather as a point of, oh, you should hate or envy those people who have, you know, who have decent pensions and actual health care and, you know, benefits. Oh my God.
Well, really, they should be thinking, hey, look, I've told some of my family, I said, no, it's you that's getting ripped off. It's not the union that's getting away with murder. You're getting ripped off.
Yeah, but
they don't seem to get that.
All of this language, you know, right to work instead of right to work for less. This whole idea that you know we're all independent. There is no society. It's a group of individuals. You know, it's dog eat dog world. This is a sociopathic view of America and of the economy. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, and I certainly have seen the same thing in the Midwest. Actually, I've seen it all over the country, but in particular in the Midwest. You're very right. And you know what the main voice is that's echoing this kind of stuff, Paul? It's Fox News and right-wing talk radio. It's just, you know, they are constantly on that topic of the big union bosses and the unions and these guys. Look at these public employees are making more than people in the private sector. How dare they? You know, without pointing out that it wasn't that way for 50 years. And when it got that way, it's because the private sector got ripped off. Thanks, Paul.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Did you know 200,000 jobless Americans lost their unemployment benefits last weekend thanks to the Republicans?
When it all amounts to nothing, it's together we don't stand. There is power in a union.
Speaking of the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather not have you here. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Bill in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, just on your screener, I was very happy to hear the name of Diane Hendricks' company come out over there, ABC Supply. I know a little bit about that company. When I lived in Wisconsin, I used to sell them some roofing metal. Her husband tragically died a few years ago. He fell through the roof of the house they were building and fell to his death. And
ouch.
Therefore, this Diane became the richest woman in Wisconsin by virtue of that fall. The business ABC Supply, I don't believe her husband even had a high school diploma. He started the business because his dad was a contractor, and he got tired of seeing the way his dad was treated. And I don't want to put words into his mouth or the company, make up a company model, but I think the premise of the company getting started was, you know, maybe treat people the way you want to be treated.
Okay.
And I don't know his politics, but I just have a feeling he might not be resting too comfortably right now with what his wife's doing.
Oh, it's very interesting.
But anyway.
But that's all speculation. But it's an interesting backstory. Bill, thanks for the call. Brooke in Rye, New York. Hey, Brooke, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I just wanted to piggyback on the guy who called earlier saying he received a fundraising letter from Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
I also received one, and I've been receiving them from the Republican Party for years.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do, which is very, what gives me a lot of satisfaction, is I check the donation box for other. I tape every nickel and penny I can so it weighs a ton, and then I mail it back so they pay the postage.
Okay.
My little prank.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, one time, this years ago, I got so upset with a fundraising letter that I taped it to a brick. and just an old red brick. I still remember that brick, and wrapped it all up and shipped it back with the return. You know, now I think that there's been a change in the postal law. Like, it used to be that you could ship back a brick, you know, with that first class postage thing on there, and they would have to pay for it. I think now there's a certain weight threshold, but I could be wrong. I don't know. But Brooke, thanks for the smile. I appreciate the story. Kelvin in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Hey, Kelvin, what's up?
Hello again, Tom. I got a question for you, maybe two. If you bring back the fairness doctrine, would it make Citizens United irrelevant?
No.
It wouldn't?
No.
Okay. In North Carolina, they just had the Republican primary. Were equal ballot boxes open for Democrats to vote for the Amendment 1?
Well, that's something I've been trying to find out, and I haven't been able to find a good story on it, and I haven't gotten a clear answer. My understanding is that there were both Republican and Democratic primaries, but that the Republican primaries were the ones that were really hotly contested. But and so Republicans were overrepresented, and of course they would vote overwhelmingly, you know, in favor of ballot initiative one to ban gay marriage in the state. But I can't say that authoritatively. I have not yet found a story that nails that. Maybe the folks in the chat room can track this down for us while we're on the air, and they'll pop it up. Okay. And once I figure it out, I'll let you know right here. Thanks a lot for the call, Calvin. Nazir, watching us on Free Speech TV in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on Dish Network. Hey, Nazir, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a recent listener to your show, and I really admire your program very much.
Thank you.
My question is, Tom, isn't it time that the government for the people should invest in the infrastructure for the government, for the people in this country? I believe that workers are the most valuable, important asset to this country, and they have been disenfranchised by the entire process. Isn't it time that the failing banks and companies that moved there shut down the factories here? Isn't it time for us to nationalize business here so that the workers can have their equal share?
I don't think the nationalization is the way to do it. Putting something under government control or ownership doesn't necessarily make it better. And, in fact, the experience of the Soviet Union was that it makes it worse. I do think, however, that strongly regulating businesses, bringing back, you know, Reagan stopped in 1982, stopped enforcing the Sherman antitrust law that had been on the books since 1881. He stopped it in 1982, so it lasted 101 years. That law said that if a corporation gets so big, or even a small group of corporations get so big that they basically dominate a market, they have to be broken up, that's anti-competitive. And they become a trust functionally. And when Reagan stopped enforcing that, you had all these mergers and acquisitions, and then Reagan also changed the laws on the purchase of a company, that it used to be that if you owned a company and I bought it, for, say you own a company that's worth $1 million, and I want to buy that company. It used to be I'd have to come up with $1 million to buy your company. After Reagan changed the laws, now I can go to a bank, and the bank will loan me $1 million, and I buy your company for $1 million, and you leave with your $1 million, right? And now I take that $1 million debt that was in my name when I went to the bank and assign it to the company. So now the company has $1 million debt. So then I tell the bank, tell the company, you've got to pay off that $1 million debt and generate some cash. And so the company lays off a third of its workforce. Everybody works 12-hour days instead of 8-hour days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the long-term, well-paid people get fired, get replaced with part-time people, no benefits. And eventually the company pays off that $1 million debt. And when they do, I now own a company that's worth $1 million that is debt-free and that is spinning off cash. And then I sell that company for $1 million. And so I get my $1 million back plus all the money I made in between. That's what Bain Capital does. That's how Mitt Romney made his living, is buying companies, loading them with debt, having them pay their own debt. Clear Channel's going through this right now. And having them pay their own debt and basically screwing all the workers. And that, for example, is the sort of thing that should be outlawed. It should, you know, it was illegal before the Reagan administration, and it should be illegal again. And there are entire industries that have come about as a consequence of deregulation that I think have been really, really bad for America. So that would be my step, is rather than having the government buy the companies or nationalize them, take them, although there are some assets like our oil that I think that we should nationalize, I would say let's have them operate within particular constraints. Nazir, thank you for the call. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, on Think Progress, I'm sure you're aware of this graph that shows union membership declining, and that's correlated with middle-class income shrinking.
Yeah, it's been going on for 40 years.
Yeah. Well, I just found this website called I'm not saying that I agree with it. I'm just trying. It's a question I have for you. I want to get your response. This conservative website, campaignforliberty.com, is trying to refute this graph that Ed Schultz put on the air from Think Progress. And they're saying that that compensation has tracked productivity. Their graph only shows up to 1997 for some reason, whereas Think Progress went to...
Because probably the numbers got funny then, Noah. I can tell you, and thank you for the call, the Think Progress graph is solid. The other thing that you need to watch is the difference, the spread between productivity and worker income. And here's the deal, and Ravi Batra has talked about this. Ravi Batra is an economist, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, author of a bunch of New York Times bestselling books on economics, and his website is Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. And what he has pointed out over and over and over again on this program, and it's just so solid, is that for, hundreds of years, what we saw was that worker productivity tracked worker wages. And, so if workers became more productive, either as a consequence of themselves working harder or more efficiently, or improvements in technology. As workers became more productive, companies became more profitable, worker wages went up. And they pretty much tracked one-on-one until the 1980s. And, Ronald Reagan came along and basically decoupled these two. And he did it by declaring war on labor unions. Because it was labor unions who said, hey, you're making extra money, pay us part of it. We created that wealth for you. The right-wingers love to run around and talk about the job creator. What about the wealth creators? The people who create wealth are the people who are the working people. They're the people doing things, creating things, making things happen. So anyhow, the spread between wages and productivity started to open up. And productivity continued to increase. Productivity has increased steadily, pretty much at the same pace, decade over decade, for the last 100 years or more. Productivity has continually increased, and almost in a straight line. Worker wages followed that up until the 80s and then leveled off. They've been flat for the last 30 some odd years. And what has filled in that gap between worker wages and productivity? Two things. The money that was in that gap went to the CEOs and the stockholders. So the rich get much, much richer. And the standard of living, which workers used to be able to maintain by their productivity going up, with their wages going up the same rate their productivity went up, that fell, and so workers are making less. And so as a consequence, they filled in that gap with credit. They filled in that gap by mortgaging their homes, second mortgaging their homes, getting some money, running up bills on their credit cards, sending their kids to college with student loans instead of paying for it. All of these things, they filled that gap with credit. Which is why, and even cars, it used to be people bought cars, now people lease them. They rent them, basically. Credit. And that's what's killing America. Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And as I mentioned, 200,000 Americans lost their unemployment benefits over the weekend because Republicans 6 months ago demanded only 79 weeks of unemployment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff Reifman is on the line with us. He's with EnvisionSeattle.org. He's the co-founder of Envision Seattle. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us about Envision Seattle.
Sure. Well, Envision Seattle, we're sponsoring Initiative 103 to try to get the ordinance on the ballot to give Seattle voters a chance to ban corporate spending in Seattle elections and to restrict corporate lobbying, and to create a community bill of rights that would include rights for nature.
That's extraordinary. So this is Initiative 103, right?
Yeah, the website, the short answer to the website is
I-103.org. I-103.org, okay.
Right.
Now, the City Council of Seattle is today voting on a resolution to ask the Wisconsin State Legislature and Congress to pass a constitutional amendment that would reverse Citizens United. And go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm standing outside Seattle City Hall right now. There's an event, a rally right before we go in to listen to the council and for them to vote on the issue.
Right.
Initiative 103 is not part of that organizing, but we support it.
Yeah, and somebody noted that undoing Citizens United would only take us back to 2010, but I would argue if we undo it with a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech, you're actually rolling back Supreme Court doctrine that goes all the way back to 1815 in the Dartmouth case. And that,
I agree.
You know, so it could be a real BFD. Initiative 103 is a citywide, it's for the city of Seattle?
Yeah, it's a city ordinance, and we need 20,600 voters to sign up to say that they want this on the ballot in November.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if it's enacted by voters, it would become the law of the city immediately.
Do they have
to? It would affect.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, we believe it would have an immediate impact.
Yeah. Do people have to physically sign a ballot or petition, rather, or can they do it online?
It's a little bit of both. They have to go online and download a paper petition,
mm-hmm.
and they can sign that in. They can get a few friends to sign it, and they can send it to us.
Okay.
Drop it off.
So they can do that at iwant103.org.
Yeah, just click on there's a big download petition button. And we're also really looking for volunteers here in Seattle who care about this issue, who know that corporate power is really hurting our society and want to pass laws that start to limit those powers. And so if people want to volunteer, we're doing fairs this weekend and next weekend where we're going to be gathering tens of thousands of signatures, hopefully, or thousands and thousands of signatures.
Jeff, we're talking with Jeff Reifman, the co-founder of Envision Seattle. Jeff, how did Envision Seattle, how did you start this gig? I'm assuming that the Koch brothers didn't come along and say, hey, here's $1 million, start something.
No, a little differently. I had interviewed Richard Grossman of PopCloud about 8 years ago for an article I was doing about Microsoft citizenship practices with Seattle Weekly.
Uh-huh.
And Richard encouraged me. He really blew up my mind and made me really change my thinking around corporate power. And he encouraged me to come out and do one of their weekend democracy schools that they were conducting.
Mm-hmm.
And that really just changed my worldview. It really opened my eyes to how entrenched corporate power is in culture and in law.
Yeah. For those people who don't know, Richard Grossman has recently passed away, but he was an amazing man. And POCLAD is the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD. They've got their own website, and they've been fighting this fight for years and years and years. When I wrote on Equal Protection back in 99, Richard Grossman and POCLAD were tremendous resources for me. And so it's great that the Richard and POCLAD inspired you, and then you just started this with somebody else.
Yeah, we're working with a pastor, Rich Lang, from University Temple United Methodist Church in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
and together we've built a growing and sizable coalition of volunteers who care about this issue. The other thing is that we're not acting alone. Like, part of our theory of change that our organizing model is that we're trying to inspire other communities. So mm-hmm. Spokane and Bellingham in Washington, there are now three cities in Washington gathering signatures to place initiatives on the ballot to strip corporate constitutional rights.
That
and
is
to end corporate personhood. It's an incredible moment here in Washington.
That is absolutely spectacular. And, of course, you're being listened to right now all across the United States and around the world as well, but particularly all around the United States. And so if somebody in any other city hears hears your voice here, Jeff, and says, hey, I'd like to do this, what do they do?
They can email me. I'm just jeff@i103.org. And we're putting together a web toolkit for other communities that want to do this. They can also visit we're not working directly with, but the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund runs democracy schools. They have their website, CELDF.org.
Right. This is Tom Lindsay's organization. They're brilliant.
They have a bunch of resources and ordinances that people can take a look at.
Yes. There's another website that I would recommend, too, and that's movetoamend.org, which has increasingly is connecting with a lot of these groups in a coalition way. To bring about a constitutional amendment that will do two things. One, say corporations aren't people, and two, say money is property, not speech. And those two things will blow up a lot of Supreme Court-created law over the last century and a half.
And one of the issues there is, you know, that's going to take a long time. There's a sign out front here at the rally of all the Washington state legislatures who haven't made a position on Citizens United yet. And we're going to be waiting a long time. So our Initiative 103, we're trying to pass a law locally now and to push this up from the grassroots and to do it with other cities, like in Bellingham, like in Spokane, and maybe some of your listeners are going to start the next one. And we're not going to wait. We're not going to ask permission to have our democracy back. We're trying to legislate it through the voters now.
There you go. And that's what Tom Lindsay and CELDEF are doing in cities all over the United States in a variety of ways, from legislating it to lawsuiting it, basically. And it's brilliant work. And, Jeff, I so salute you. It is a courageous and powerful thing to step out there and say, okay, I'm gonna try and put this thing together. And good luck with the Seattle City Council. The website is iwant103.org.
No, sorry. I103.org.
I want 103.
No. I103.org.
Oh, the letter I followed by the numbers 103.org.
Right.
Okay. I103.org.
Thank you very much.
Misunderstood. Tom. Thank you, Jeff. Good luck.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what, what is the appropriate role of government versus the private sector? Where does the commons begin and end? Harris Kenny is a policy analyst with the Reason Foundation. Reason.org is their website and the co-editor of their annual privatization report. Harris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So you're celebrating, I guess, the level of privatization, the number of prison rooms, what do you call them, cells, I guess, that have been taken out of government hands and put into the hands of people who make a profit off it, the number of water systems that have been taken out of government hands and put into the hands of people who can make a profit off it, the number of electrical systems that have been taken out of government hands, out of the hands of we the people, and put in the hands of fat cats who can make a profit off it. Why are you celebrating this?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. So in our report that just came out, it's actually not positive or supporting or criticizing. It's just basically saying what's happened.
The whole point of the Reason Foundation is to support privatization, is it not?
We do support privatization when it makes sense, but this report isn't necessarily a celebration. It's basically saying what's going on. And in this report, you're right, we look at corrections, education, water, and I would question your premise that we're taking things out of the commons and giving them to greedy fat cats. A lot of times these are actually lease agreements and, you know, handing over to nonprofits, and we're maintaining public ownership over assets. So I'm not entirely sure your premise.
Well, thank you. Where should the commons begin and end? I mean, if it's not the job of all of us, we the people, I mean, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, there are certain things that are so important to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to literally be able to live and be free, that you don't want them in the hands of somebody whose primary interest is not serving the public good, whose primary interest is making money. And I would think at the very top of that would be things like water.
Sure. Well, I think what I would say is that I agree. There are definitely core functions of government. And if you read through the report, what we're seeing is basically policymakers at the state and local level are out of money. And so they're finding different ways to deliver services.
But they're not out of money. They're only out of money in those states where right-wingers have passed laws like in California and Oregon that require where the legislature can't raise taxes without a supermajority. They're only out of money in those states where Republicans run the state, and they're absolutely unwilling to raise taxes. You have corporate revenue right now, corporate tax revenue, that was 35% of all government spending back in the 1950s and 60s. It's now less than 10% of government spending. I mean, there's a lot of money being made in this country, and there's a lot of people making a lot of money in this country. It's not that governments are out of money. It's that the governments are being restrained by people who share your philosophy.
Well, actually, government revenue has been going up for decades. So I'm not sure what numbers you're talking about.
Because inflation has been lowering the value of the dollar for decades. But government spending in real dollars right now is at a 60-year low. 60 years.
Is that, I mean, are you including federal, state,
yes,
local? I'm not sure the
yes
source of your statistics, but, I mean, government is doing more than they ever have before. So I'm not sure the source of the data you're
No, actually, our government has been consistently shrinking over the last decade or so. Well, other than, you know, Bush blowing it up for the military.
Where is the evidence of that?
Well, the number of government employees. We've had 470,000 government employees laid off since Barack Obama became president. Now, most of them were laid off in red states by Republican governors, but the net number of government employees nationwide has dropped by almost 500,000 just in the last 3 years. Government is getting smaller.
Does the data you're looking at include full-time equivalent employees? Because oftentimes what they'll do is they'll fire employees, but in reality they're just closing open positions that haven't been filled yet. So
I frankly don't know. I do believe that the numbers are pretty solid,
yeah,
though. But the point
in my hometown of Denver is basically they said we've had hundreds of layoffs, but in actuality, almost all of the layoffs have been vacant positions that have not been filled. So a person wasn't fired, an equivalent of a person that would have been filled.
Okay. Well, instead of dueling numbers here, Harris.
Yeah.
We're talking with Harris Kenny, a policy analyst at the Reason Foundation. Why should any community surrender their sovereignty and control over their water supply to a French corporation?
Sure. Well, water is actually a great example. So
and the French are the biggest owners of private water supplies in the United States and around the world now. So why should
several large-scale concessionaires? And obviously, France is not a radical right-wing country.
No, but their corporations are. And the corporation in France, what is it called, Aqua?
There are several, and there are quite a few private sector water companies.
They have absolutely ravaged a number of communities. I mean, it's just did you ever read the story of what happened down in what was it, Ecuador? I believe it was when Bechtel and another couple of companies came in and privatized their water supply and said to people, "We now own the rainwater," because most of the people in this poor area took their water supply from off their roofs. And said, you know, you've got to pay us when you take water off your roof, and the people revolted?
I'm not familiar with that story. What I'll say is this, and there's lots of horror stories of public and private management of assets, you name it, water, roads, parking. The key is in the contract. And so basically, like, my premise is simple. It's that if we can't trust the public sector to contract and oversee something like water, then why do we expect them to own it, operate it, and maintain it? If they can't even contract and oversee it, why would we expect that they could operate it? So, I mean,
Your premise is flawed, Harris. Your premise assumes that you can't trust government. And if you can't trust government, it's because it's been corrupted by something. And in most cases, what it's been corrupted by is corporate money.
Well, I say that you can trust them, but I don't want a conflict. I don't want the fox guarding the hen house. I want government to be overseeing, and I want the private sector to be held accountable through contracts. Whereas under normal public provision,
why throw somebody in the middle? Why say, okay, this community, you know, we've got a million people in this community and they all need water and we're going to provide that water and, you know, we, the city, whatever, we're going to build a water treatment plant. I mean, this is how it traditionally was done. We'll build a water treatment plant. We'll sell 20-year bonds to raise the money and all that. Why should we hand that over to a private for-profit corporation that has to skim at least 10 or 15% off the top to be able to distribute dividends, to their shareholders, and that is paying their CEOs millions of dollars? Why should we do that? Why should we, the people, ever have to have private contractors involved in things the government is doing that involve the commons?
That's a fair question. Well, I guess what I would say is that we, the people, aren't necessarily doing that because we don't have a direct democracy. It's our representatives that are choosing to do that.
Via our representatives.
I think they choose to do it for a few reasons. One is that private sector companies when there's oversight through contracts, they're able to bring in best practices from, you know, national work. And
government can do that just as well. You know, NASA works really, really well. Social Security Administration's never failed to, you know, has never bounced a check or failed to write a check. I mean, the government actually does think the Army, you know, everybody says, oh, it's very efficient, works very well. The government is actually competent. It's just it needs to be held to account by we the people. But you guys want to take it away from the we the people, put it in the hands of a fat cat who's responsive to nobody. You know, if I show up at a private corporation to protest the CEO, I get arrested. If I show up in my member of Congress's office with a sign, you know, I'm a patriot.
Well, Tom, I mean, these contracts are being done by elected officials. I mean, if people don't like what is done,
elected officials who are being bought and paid by these companies. And this is my whole point, is that because of the Supreme Court doctrine that money is somehow speech and not property. Then and therefore protected under the First Amendment, you've got corporations corrupting government, and it's a horrible thing. And I think that you're enabling it. In fact, if anything, encouraging it.
Well, I mean, I think voters are the ones that are putting these people in office, and voters need to be accountable. So if voters aren't paying attention,
so it's all you dirty voters' fault.
I'm a voter too.
Okay, Harris Kenny, Reason.org. Thanks, Harris.
Thanks, Tom. Have a good day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where should the commons begin and end, and what is the appropriate role of government? My thoughts on that right after this.
Stress cell. Stress cell. Help.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and James in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I want to say good job. I appreciate you out there using your right to free speech. I agree with probably 60% of what you say.
But?
About 60.
Okay. But?
What is it
you're calling up to argue with me about, James?
Well, not to argue, but I would appreciate if you'd be a little more balanced a little bit. And the reason I say that is you were talking to a gentleman about water rights. And you said something to him that I 110% agree with. You said the politicians in this country are they're the bought and paid for talking heads of the global national corporations.
By and large.
And
not all of them, but most of them, yeah.
Well, but most of them. The problem is when you say most of them, most of the Republicans and most of the Democrats.
I'd say all of the Republicans and many of the Democrats, but yeah.
Well, okay, let's say all of the Republicans. See, when you say things like that, there's good Republicans and there's good Democrats. There's good Libertarians. I know
well,
Libertarians.
Can you name one good Republican?
I'm sorry?
I think the Republican Party has successfully purged its ranks of anybody who's not an ALEC corporate drone. Can you name one?
Well, see.
One good Republican in the House or Senate?
Yeah, Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, who wants to end Social Security, who wants to end Medicare.
He doesn't want to end those things.
He absolutely does. He said that they're unconstitutional.
He wants to privatize them.
Which ends them. He wants government to get...
privatizes them.
No, he doesn't want government to have oversight over them because they're unconstitutional. He wants to simply say, if you want to have a pension, call up J.P. Morgan Chase. Jamie Dimon would be glad to talk to you.
Let me ask you this. 4 years of Obama, $2 trillion in new debt. That means that even if he's not reelected, we're going to see the inflation rate double in the next 2 years.
Well, what about the $10 trillion in new debt that in fact, by the way, the $3 trillion in debt that was run up by Ronald Reagan, if you were to inflate it to today's dollars, would be more like $10 trillion. But what about the original $10 trillion? What about the course that George W. Bush put us on with his tax cut for millionaires and billionaires and his two wars and his unpaid for Medicare program that gave drug benefits? It wasn't terrible.
It was
strategic, James. It wasn't terrible at all. It was strategic.
No,
it was a strategy.
James,
I am sorry. They were following a path that was laid out back in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, with this two Santa Clauses doctrine that Jude Winansky came up with. Jude Winansky was a Republican strategist in the 1970s, and he said the Republican, and I Google two Santa Clauses. And Jude Waninsky, and you will find this, and in fact, you'll find articles that I've written about it. Jude Waninsky sat down and said, what's the Republicans? You know, this was after Barry Goldwater's horrific loss in 1964. And after Richard Nixon went down in flames then in 73. And Jude Waninsky's looking at the Republican Party in tatters, right? It was devastated by Goldwater's loss. And then Nixon comes along and they thought, oh, finally we got a president. Oh, wait a minute, he's a crook. And so the Republican Party was wiped out. And so he was asking the question, why is it Republicans can't win elections? And the answer was fairly obvious. The Democrats have been the party of Santa Claus. The Republicans have been the party of Scrooge. The Republican, you know, the Democrats said, hey, let's have an 8-hour work, you know, or an 8-hour day, work day instead of a 10-hour work day. And the Republicans said, no. The Democrats said, hey, let's get kids out of the labor force. Let's have child labor laws. The Republicans said, no. Democrats said, hey, let's have unemployment benefits for people. The Republicans said, no. Democrats said, hey, let's provide people with Social Security. The Republicans said, no. The Democrats said, hey, let's provide people with unemployment benefits. The Republicans said, no. The Republicans have always been the party of no when it came to anything except money for big corporations and fat cats. And Jude Waninsky acknowledged this and said, we've got to become the party of Santa Claus, just like the Democrats are, because all these things that I just described, the Republicans view as Democratic efforts to bribe the populace. I view them as, hey, you like what somebody does, you vote for them. But, you know, whatever. The Republicans, you know, so Jude Waninsky says the Democratic Party is the party of Santa Claus. So how does the Republican Party do two things? How do they accomplish two really important things? Number one, become a party of Santa Claus, a different kind of Santa Claus, but a party of Santa Claus. And number two, force the Democrats to shoot the Santa Claus that they've created with Social Security and Medicare and unemployment insurance and all these other things. How do you force the Democratic Party to become the anti-Santa Claus Party and make the Republican Party the Santa Claus Party? And he said, it's really simple. What we do is we start yelling about tax cuts constantly. Whenever Republicans are in power, we give tax cuts. It doesn't matter that they will run up a huge debt. In fact, it's a good thing that they will run up a huge debt. So Ronald Reagan comes into office, and in 8 years, he runs up more debt. He borrows more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. It was epic. It was mass. He tripled the national debt. No president had ever done that in history. We didn't do that fighting World War II. So Reagan leaves this massive debt behind and then kicks in. And then George Bush leaves, you know, adds another $1 trillion to that debt. And then Bill Clinton becomes president. And part two of the two Santa Claus theory kicks in, which is force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. As soon as a Democrat takes office, stop yelling about tax cuts and start yelling about the debt that you created. Just don't mention that. And so as soon as a Democrat comes into office, you start calling talk shows and go, what's this big debt? We're going to be a disaster. You write letters to the editor. You do everything you can to get out that message that the debt is the evil thing. And the Democrats then will be forced to deal with the debt. They will be forced to deal with the irresponsibility of the Republican that preceded them. And to do that, they're going to have to cut back on their own social programs. They're going to have to shoot their own Santa Claus. Ha ha, this is great. This will have Republicans in power forever. That was what Jude Waninsky thought. It's what he laid out in his memo. It got published in the Wall Street Journal. It became the operating manual for the Reagan administration and then for the Bush administration. And then during the Clinton administration, the Republicans immediately started screaming about the debt. As soon as Bill Clinton came into office, to appease them, he ended welfare as we know it. When he raised taxes by 3 points on rich people and ended up with a balanced budget, Newt Gingrich took the floor and said, this will cause a Great Depression. And then as soon as Bush came into power, back to the tax cuts. This is insanity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But when the Republicans did this, to my last caller, when the Republicans did this, they weren't thinking this is a horrible thing. They were thinking this is the strategy.
Just another manic Monday. Wish it was Sunday. That's not
funny. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Let me add, you know, I laid out the two Santa Claus theory, the Republican game plan, the rule book, as it were, that they've been playing from since the mid-1970s when they were pushing Jimmy Carter to privatize things. Oh, yeah, privatization is wonderful. It's going to create all kinds of prosperity. You just need to, you know, eliminate government oversight over things like the travel industry or the you know, and fill in the blanks. The trucking industry. Let's eliminate government oversight over the trucking industry. What happened? Well, now your truck drivers are screwed. You know, compared to the generation that was driving trucks in the 60s and early 70s. And, well, throughout the 70s. I mean, Carter's deregulation took effect in 78, 79. And really, you know, you saw the fruit of it through the 80s. But the other half of the plan, you know, the first half of the plan had these two parts. When Republicans are in power, spend like crazy and run up huge debts. And then when Democrats come into power, scream about the deficit and force them to cut social spending to shoot their own Santa Claus. Okay, that's the first half of it. The second half of it is make outrageous statements, right? Make people believe that up is down, that inside is out, that red is green. I mean, it just the big lie theory. Just make stuff up and just keep throwing it out there and throwing it out there and throwing it out there. And eventually people will believe that John Kerry wasn't actually a hero in the Vietnam War. Eventually people will believe, you know, that he knew back when he was 19 years old or 20 years old, that he was one day going to be running for president of the United States, and he ran out and nicked his hand on a hunting knife and then said he'd been shot or whatever. I mean, you know, just make up the most absurd stuff you can come up with. Like saying that economic crash that started with the housing market crashing in 2007 and 2008, mostly 2007 and 2000, well, through 2008, but when the housing, I remember on this program, I believe it was the mid or the late part of 2007, it might have been early 2008, when there was a quarter where housing starts were down by 30%, more than 30%, and I said on this program, this is the beginning of the crash. You are going to see a crash coming out of this because I have read the history of the Great Depression, and the housing market crashed in 1927. It started in Florida. The housing market had been this incredible bubble that started with the Harding, when Harding came into office in 1921 with this huge tax increase, cut the top tax rate from 75% down to 25%, and all that hot money started flowing into Florida and land deals. There were literally people standing on the streets buying and selling property, dealing with deeds on the streets. And that bubble so inflated, a $1,000 property became a $10,000 property. That bubble so inflated that when it burst in 2007, housing started to crack, and then it echoed across the country, out to California and all the way up to New York, to the point where by mid to late 1928, the housing market was just gone to hell. And so in October 1929, the stock market followed it a year later. And I predicted that on this show. So the second half to the Republican strategy to have power, the first half is, you know, play this kind of brutal game with debt and with people's lives. And then the second half is to lie about who's responsible. Like, for example, take the crash of the housing market, you know, this bubble that was all caused, in my opinion, by the initial Reagan tax cut. Larry Beinhart has done a brilliant job of chronicling this. How we had no bubbles because for really, really rich people, money was dear. 91% income tax rate, 74% income tax rate, right up until Reagan came, until 86, I think it was. And then Reagan crashes that down to 28%, and everything goes to hell. And we start this cycle, a bubble, boom, burst, boom, burst, boom, burst. So that cycle was coming around in 2008, and George Bush was just pumping it for all it's worth. You remember what he said after 9/11? First thing you should do, go shopping. Pump the bubble. And then, you know, Bush crashes the economy. The Republicans, the 30 years of Reaganomics crashes the economy. And then you get Dick Morris on Fox News and have him lie about it and blame it on Obama. Here you go.
When he took office, public sector debt of all nations, all states, everybody in the world,
it's the debt,
was $40 trillion. He increased it himself by $5 trillion and state and local governments by another $4 trillion. So he, a 25% increase in debt in 3 years. And it totally freaked out the world. It had led to the crisis in Greece, the crisis in Spain, the freezing of lending of capital throughout the world.
Dick Morris lying through his teeth, and he knows it. I mean, Dick Morris is one of a small number of people who I have so little respect for, because he's a paid shill, and he knows he's a paid shill. I mean, some of these people actually believe what they're saying. But anyway, so there you have it. Lay it all out. Russ in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Russ, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, thanks. Great show. Yeah, if I heard the previous caller correct, he's from Champaign, and I am in the same water district as he is, and it irked me because he was talking about the water company. Our water company here is private, and in about 4 years ago, it raised its fees 40%. Shortly after that, it got another raise of 20% in fees.
Wow.
And then now I think they got are asking for, recently got another 40% increase. And to add insult to injury, they went from sending the citizens a bill every 2 months to every 1 month. So it looks like their fees are going, you know, each bill is smaller, but it doesn't come as much. So this guy lives in a good example of why private water doesn't work well for the users.
Yeah, but, and this is the point. The reason why the founders of this country created this country, I mean, we were arguably one of the first big national experiments of this idea that John Locke had come up with, that people could self-govern and that they could become responsible for the commons. It used to be the king owned the commons. The king owned everything. And you know, so there was this radical idea of life, liberty, and private property as John Locke put it in his second treatise on government in the 1670s. And so, you know, we tried that in 1776. And the whole idea is that there are these things that are essential to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, like our schools, like our water supply. I mean, they would, if they'd known about electricity back then, Ben Franklin was playing with it, they would have said the electric supply, particularly given, you know, how essential it is to life now. I would say, frankly, our natural resources. But they said these are the appropriate, our educational system, our police, our armies, these are the appropriate provinces of we the people, where we should control it, we should make the decisions about it, and nobody should be making a profit of it. Here, Franklin Roosevelt during World War II, and thank you for the call, Russ. Franklin Roosevelt during World War II, and I think I know you've got this clip there, Jacob, someplace, is where he talked about he didn't want any new war millionaires. This is emblematic of that kind of thinking. Here, just listen to this.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
You get that? No new war millionaires. I mean, we believe in we the people. So anyway, it's everything's an opportunity to make a buck. Dean in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I read an excerpt of your book about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. In there, you had mentioned that for regular people, not the millionaires and billionaires, when taxes go up, in the short run, there will be less money in their pocket. But over the long run, 1 to 3 years, you said, their wages will actually increase.
That's correct.
I guess my question is, to me, it's a little hard to understand how that works. I mean,
okay. Let me lay it out. There's two markets for compensation, shall we call it? Okay. I'm reluctant to call it wages because in one of those markets, it's typically not called that. But there's two markets for compensation, and one of those markets has basically no limit on it. And the other market is highly limited. So you've got the average working person, they're operating in a supply and demand economy where the amount of money that they're paid is a function of basically what an employer could find somebody to replace them for. You with me so far?
Yep.
So you know, if somebody's a carpenter, well, what do carpenters typically make? Okay, oh, they make $35,000 a year or $25,000, you know, whatever it may be. Let's say they make $35,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what does that equal? Okay, and you know, that's what the pay is, okay? Then the other universe of people lives in a universe where, and this is like the CEOs, where there's basically no supply-demand. It's basically get what you can. It's the Mitt Romney world, okay? Mm-hmm. And for those people, for the people in that unlimited income universe, when their taxes go down, their wealth goes up. On the other hand, for the people who are, this is when taxes go down. For the people, let's say you got a carpenter who's, you know, the market for carpenters is 35 grand pre-tax, and the tax rate is at, you know, whatever it is, and so 10 grand of that 35 is going to taxes. They're netting 25 when they go home. So really what those carpenters are working for is 25,000 a year. Now, if the taxes went up so radically that their income went down to 20,000 a year, you would have people who could no longer afford to be carpenters. So wages over time would go up by $5,000 a year to compensate for that, you know, for that increase in taxes. And whereas, I'm going to have to repeat this again, Dean, on the other side of the break, because I know it's starting to get confusing. I'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So it's really simple. For working people, when taxes go up, wages will go up so that their take-home pay stays the same.
It's been 1 week since you looked at me. Got 10 in the side, but I'm angry. 5 days since you laughed at me. Then get back together, come back and see me. 3 days in the living room. I realize it's all my fault.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. The German embassy starts next week, right, Victoria?
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. All right, great. Welcome. What's up?
Thank you. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid went ballistic today.
Really? Ballistic?
Well, for him, yes.
Oh, you mean he raised his voice and raised his arm?
He raised his voice and waved his arms about. He's furious.
Amazing.
Over the Export-Import Bank.
Now, it's interesting. I had somebody, Brian Darling from the Heritage Foundation, call me out on this last week on my TV show. And I frankly, I don't know much about the Export-Import Bank. He said, why are Democrats supporting the Export-Import Bank? And I said, I don't have any idea. Tell me about it.
Well, I don't know a lot about it, but what it is what it does is it guarantees loans to foreign purchasers of U.S. exports.
Right.
So basically, it has a big impact on aerospace, power, heavy machinery and construction industries.
And the weapons industry.
And weapons industries, yeah.
Yeah, the military industrial
complex. So big industries. Now, some conservatives oppose it on principle. They say it's a government subsidy. The fact is that the bank is actually self-funded through fees. So it's not a government subsidy.
That's interesting.
So that's actually important to know as we get to why Harry Reid went ballistic.
Okay.
The House passed a bill to reauthorize the Export-Import Bank, which has to be exported by May, not export, it has to be reauthorized by May the 31st.
Okay, so if the House passed this, that means that you had Republicans on board.
Republicans on board in the House.
Was this bipartisan?
Bipartisan in the House.
Okay.
To get this done.
Okay.
Has to be done by the end of the month. Otherwise, they can't guarantee these loans to foreign purchasers of U.S. exports.
Right.
Comes to the Senate. Always been bipartisan before. This sails through on a voice vote. That's what Harry Reid tried to do last week. And suddenly he hears, we've got amendments. Oh, really? What amendments? Student loans. Well, what's that got to do with it? Oh, and I've got an amendment that I want to close it down completely. Really? And he went ballistic then, too. So today, he says that even though Republicans say they support it, they want to eliminate it. He said even though there's outward support for this legislation, they want to kill this bill. They don't want government to have anything to do with our lives, period, nothing, which is unrealistic in this modern world and, in fact, in any world. They're, because they've got amendments that would limit the ability of the bank to make loans.
Right. It's very interesting because when Brian brought that up, I thought, okay, this has got to be, you know, Brian's with Heritage. This has got to be this is the point of the spear, right? If he's saying this to me, they're saying this to Republicans. And pretty soon the Republicans are going to start saying no to the Export-Import Bank. And that's when I made a mental note, learn about the Export-Import Bank, which, you know, that was just Friday, which I haven't done yet. Here's my prophecy on this, Victoria. If the Export-Import Bank is supporting or subsidizing U.S. exports, and every government figures out a way to do that, whether it's reversing VAT taxes or subsidizing buyers or whatever it may be, every government figures out a way to do that. If you can blow that up, if you can stop the subsidy of exports, you are going to probably lay off 500,000 or 1 million people in the United States very, very quickly when those export purchases go away. And that is going to spike up the unemployment rate. And if you can get that to happen before, say, August or September, then you can sail into the November elections with a business guy saying, as running for president, saying that he knows how to create jobs and he's going to put you all back to work. And the low-information voters will buy it, and the Republicans will win the White House.
Back to Harry Reid. Instead, a worthy measure that would support 300,000 American jobs may stall in the Senate this evening to hold up more Republican instructionism. You're absolutely right.
Amazing. And I was just guessing. But, you know, it doesn't take a lot to guess, because Mitch McConnell said, you know, the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated, he said our number one job in the United States Senate, the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, is to make him a one-term president. And the way that they do that is by running the economy into the ditch.
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, this is something the National Association of Manufacturers read from a letter from them today, saying it's one of the only tools manufacturers have to counter hundreds of billions of dollars of export financing that foreign governments offer to their exporters.
Wow. Amazing.
So if you've got them and the Chamber of Commerce on board, I mean, I think you get the impression that this is supported by Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah, it's supported by the Republicans who are operating in the interests of business, but
right.
it's not supported by the Republicans who are purely partisan in their agenda and just want to knock the Democrats out of office.
Very interesting.
Yeah, in my opinion. So what else is going on in the world?
Meantime, back at J.P. Morgan Chase, the number four earner there, Ina Drew, female, age 55, retired is what they're calling it today. She earned $14 million last year. She was the person in charge of the trading office that made these trades that lost $2 billion.
Out of London.
And a woman. A big proponent of women in the financial industry, by the way. She is going to take the fall for this. Senators are seeking tougher bank rules. And it's going to be interesting to see who is going to win over this one, because the banks are going to fight back. They're not going to take this lying down for very long, even though they're on the ropes right now.
Yeah, well, if you can lose $2 billion, you can also make $2 billion if your bets go right.
Exactly, exactly. So it's going to be a question of are they still going to be able to define the Volcker Rule the way they want it, or are Democrats going to be able to get in there and get it defined more stringently the way they want to. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said today that it is amazing that some, including Mitt Romney, are still looking to repeal the president's Wall Street reform law. Now, it's interesting that Mitt Romney, having said that he intended to repeal Dodd-Frank, having said that repeatedly during the primaries, now is saying that he's in favor of common sense oversight.
Yeah, common sense oversight, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. And Jacob, is this okay? We're coming out. Remarkable. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. I always learn something from Victoria. It's one of the great things of having her on. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. European stocks are falling. In fact, the U.S. stock market, I haven't looked at it in the last hour or so, but it was down most of the day, about 100 points or thereabouts. And investors around the world are keeping a close eye on Greece. Everybody says, oh, Greece, this is the nexus of the whole thing, as the euro crisis is entering a new phase. On the heels of the elections that ousted the pro-austerity government in Greece, keep in mind, you had... Papandreou, was the president of Greece, and he actually called for, you know, when the crash happened back, you know, sometime back, when the crash happened, he said, well, you know, the banksters want us to lay off government employees, cut benefits, cut pensions, like cut Social Security payments, cut their, you know, I'll use American language, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut everything, cut unemployment benefits, lay off government employees. And he said, we should at least have a vote on this, right? We should have a referendum. And the banksters said no. And he was gone in 24 hours, replaced by the guy who was the former head of the Greek Central Bank. So anyhow, so now you've got this pro-austerity government in Greece. And new, as a result of this, I mean, Greece is like bleeding. So new anti-austerity parties have so far been unable to form a coalition government. Greek President Carlos Papoulias is, now he's the president, not the prime minister. The prime minister is the guy I was talking about just a second ago. But the president is desperately trying to bring together party leaders for a meeting today in hopes of finding a coalition government. But the far-left Syriza party, S-Y-R-I-Z-A, Syriza party, and their leader, a guy by the name of Alexis Tsipras, T-S-I-P-R-A-S, is refusing to attend any meeting that includes other parties who support austerity. So neither the pro-austerity parties nor the, which is principally the conventional parties, nor the anti-austerity parties, which is the far left and the far right, won enough seats in the last election to form this coalition government, meaning that the president's probably going to have to call for a new round of elections in the next week or two. And if so, in all probability, the far left Syriza party and probably the far right party, I think it's called Golden Dawn, will pick up, and it's basically a neo-Nazi party, which Greece has never seen before. I mean, they were occupied by the Nazis. But these two parties, because they are both saying no to austerity, they're going to pick up more seats in the parliament, making an anti-austerity coalition government a very real possibility just before Greece runs out of money as early as next month. And when Greece grows broke, if the new government refuses to sign on to the IMF and the EU-backed austerity and bailout plan, then Greece will default and likely be forced out of the eurozone. So, boom, you guys are out of here. Or Greece is actually saying, no, we're taking our marbles and we're going home. The problem that they have, the reason why it's going to be difficult for Greece, unlike Argentina, well, I'll get to that in a second. Anyhow, thanks to the worldwide economic meltdown and this trickle-down austerity response, the whole Greek economy has been in a depression for at least the last 5 years. And so now maybe there could be an insight, although it could get very painful. Meanwhile, in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel saw her conservative party get crushed in state elections in North Rhine-Westphalia, the biggest state in Germany. It has the same population as the Netherlands. It's huge. This one state. It could be a country. In fact, it used to be a country. It used to be called Rhine-Westphalia. In fact, it used to be two countries. One was the Rhine region and the other was Westphalia. Merkel has been leading the charge for austerity around Europe, but she now finds herself vulnerable because the support for her party has dropped to 26%. Now, it's pretty damn hard governing when only a quarter of the people like you. This is the worst result that any political party has seen since World War II. So everywhere you look, the supporters of trickle-down austerity are getting hammered by the voters. And the simple fact of the matter is that austerity has never worked anywhere. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, pushed it for decades in South America until governments like Argentina. I was down there in 2001. You could see, you know, they just said, that's it. We are not going to take any more IMF money. And by the way, we are not going to continue this insane austerity that the IMF is shoving down our throats. IMF was, you know, they said, take a leap. Now, Argentina had their own currency, but it was pegged to the U.S. dollar. They had the Argentine peso. But they said, to hell with this, we're not going to peg the peso to the dollar anymore. We're going to disconnect it. We're not going to pay back the IMF. We're going to declare bankruptcy and stick them with the debt, and we're going to go our own way. The result for Argentina was both a recovery of national sovereignty. They got their country back, and their economy came back. It was this robust economic rebound. So now Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy and Ireland all, you know, got whacked by their banksters. and got whacked by this international crash. And frankly, in my opinion, this is my take on this. It's time for them to just say no to the international banksters and the European Central Bank. Pull out of the euro and go back to their own currencies. The Greek government right now should be running the printing presses. They should dust them off and fire them up and start printing drachmas. Now, if they do that, there will be a shock for very wealthy people, for big-time investors, particularly in Greek bonds, and for banks in Europe and America, who are going to take the loss of Greece saying, hey, we're bankrupt, we're not going to pay back our bills. But it will give the working people of Greece their country back. And largely those working people have already figured this out, which is why the Greek elections are freaking out the banksters who, like most libertarians, think that capitalism and money are more important than democracy or the lives of working people. Which brings us to the United States, where the same battle is being played out. Democrats are pushing for stimulus and growth through things like rebuilding infrastructure and extending unemployment benefits. What are the Republicans doing? Oh, we need to have austerity. They want a punishing EU-like austerity by stopping government spending, cutting unemployment benefits. You see, I've mentioned a couple of times in the show so far, you know, 100,000 people in California, 200,000 people across the country lost their unemployment benefits on Saturday. Most of them didn't know that they were about to lose them. And this was all because the Republicans insisted that if the unemployment benefits got extended back, I don't know, 2-3 months ago, 6 months ago, whenever it was, when they renegotiated this in Congress, that the 99-week be cut back to 79 weeks. Now, this in the face of the time, I mean, this is at the time that a lot of people had to hit 99 weeks and they've lost everything. So anyhow, the Republicans want to cut unemployment benefits. They want to cut Medicare. They want to cut other social safety net programs. So for us, as Americans, let's hope that Americans figure out what the Greeks already get. That when the conservatives like Paul Ryan and his bankster buddies who will take him out to dinner and buy him a $300 bottle of wine, that when the conservatives like Paul Ryan and his bankster buddies are happy, it's because you're getting screwed. The average working person is getting screwed. And that's what they're all about. That's what these guys are all about. Is you know, they have been squeezing working people ever since Reagan came into office, crushing unions, holding down wages, and now they're saying, oh, and by the way, we want austerity too. Let's wring the last few drops of blood out of this washcloth, out of the middle class. Let's throw the middle class into perpetual servitude, make them broke. Let's have student loans top $1 trillion, wipe out a whole generation. They'll be compliant and obedient after that, won't they? Right. We'll see how that works out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. So when are we going to wake up and say austerity here now? Don't think so. And throw out the Republicans. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with the Alex in Santa Cruz. It says you disagree with me, Alex. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, you talk a lot about Keynesian economics, and you look at the...
Actually, I don't talk that much about it. I don't think I've used the word more than 4 or 5 times. Oh, you mean I talk about it in principle rather than by naming Keynes?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And you look at that as a counter model to the austerity models out there, and you look at the historical epoch, you know, post-World War II boom, where debt to GDP was, what,
127%.
Yeah. And now it's like in the upper 90s or something like that. And
yep.
You talk about how we grew ourselves out of debt.
Right.
Well, I
repeatedly,
think
by the way. We did after the Civil War. We did after World War I. We did after World War II.
Yeah, but see, but the flaw in your analysis is that things were built in America then. And so, for example, you pay construction workers to build a bridge, then they spend their money on a debt basis. They spend their money at retailers who stimulate the wholesalers, who stimulate the manufacturers. And
the manufacturers are in China.
Yeah.
Now everything is in China and Mexico and South Korea, and it's even going from the coastal cities of China to inward places. They're screwing the Chinese workers too.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that here, you know, here we are. Look at the people that the workers who built the Bay Bridge, right? Where was this deal from? It's from China.
Yeah.
And where do they spend their salaries? At Walmart. So that's what I'm, that's what I think is a problem with a lot of these Republicans.
Alex, you are making my argument. I mean, if you read my book, Rebooting the American Dream, the first chapter is on trade policy. We, you know, the way and time that we really screwed this country up was when we bought into, you know, Nixon's and Reagan's whole idea, and ultimately, you know, Clinton's as well, whole idea that we should just, you know, the Tom Friedman, Milton Friedman free trade model. You know, Ross Perot had it right with, you know, with his big ears and his charts and graphs saying, you know, Jacob's digging out the quote, Ross Perot just laid it out. He was a truth teller at the time. Here he is. Listen to Ross Perot.
And you can move your factory south of the border, pay $1 an hour for labor, hire a young 25. That's assuming you've been in business for a long time. You've got a mature workforce. Pay $1 an hour for your labor. Have no health care. That's the most expensive single element in making a car. Have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
And he was absolutely right. And what he was saying, he got 20% of the vote for president of the United States with a guy as his vice president whose famous line was, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" And I'm serious. And yet people still voted for him because they knew that both Bush and Clinton were saying that they were going to sign NAFTA and the WTO and GATT and all that kind of stuff. And I've been saying from day one, I'm with Ross Perot on this, and we never should have signed these trade agreements. We shouldn't be continuing to sign these trade agreements. You know, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all of them. We need to just, you know, if George Bush could say, you know, that strategic missile treaty that we've got with the Soviets, the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, he said he was unsigning it, right? A treaty that Bill Clinton had signed. He unsigned it. If George Bush can pull us out of that kind of treaty, then President Obama or any other president should be able to pull us out of these insane treaties. And we need to do it tomorrow morning, because you're right. If you spend $1 trillion on stimulus in the United States, then first cycle through, first wash through, you're gonna produce $1 trillion worth of response. Second wash through, it's only gonna be a couple hundred million. Third wash through, it's gonna be down to tens of million, because in each one of those wash throughs, most of that money is going offshore, because when you go into almost any store in America to buy almost anything, it doesn't say made in USA on it any longer. And until we bring manufacturing back to the United States, at least for core stuff, you know, countries must be self-sufficient. A country should be able to, if there was a natural disaster, if there was something that shut down shipping worldwide. I mean, imagine if Fukushima, you know, that reactor 4 is listing and they've got 70 times more radioactive cesium on the 10th floor of a building that has been exploded and is leaning right now. 70 times more radioactive cesium than all of Chernobyl, right? This was the major radioactive product that exploded reactors send out. If that thing hit the ground and it goes off, and all the shipping across the Pacific just stops for 3 or 4 months while the radioactive levels are going back down to something rational, which you would expect it to, although maybe the shipping owners will keep their crews in the dark and let them be exposed. But if all that stopped, how could the United States function? We have to, I mean, when we went into World War II, we took our car factories and turned them into tank factories and into airplane factories. We took our nylons that made ladies' nylons and turned them into parachute factories. We took our clothing manufacturers that made jeans and socks and turned them into making uniforms and socks for the soldiers. We took our shoe factories, and now they're making boots. I mean, the amazing thing to me, Alex? Do you know where the uniforms for the U.S. border guards who are down there on the Mexican border trying to stop immigrants from Mexico coming in this country, you know where their uniforms are made?
Probably the maquiladoras in Mexico.
In Mexico, yes. I mean, tell me this isn't insane. And so, yeah.
Many of those agents are sons of immigrant Mexicans who are fluent in Spanish.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's not a paradox.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I'm all in favor of a rational immigration program into the United States, too. I mean, that's but again, you know, Reagan, I mean, you can go back to Reagan and say, you know, he's the one who who blew this thing up as well, because it was Reagan who in 86, you know, did amnesty for 5 million people and then stopped enforcing the laws that said that if you are an employer and you hire somebody who's an illegal alien, you go to jail. And I owned an ad agency back around that time, and we had to hire a guy. We were looking for somebody who was fluent in Spanish, Japanese, and English. And I ended up finding a guy down in Atlanta who was fluent in all three languages. He's born in Japan, raised in Peru, and came to college in the United States, but he wasn't a citizen. I had to go through months with the INS to get this guy permission to work for me. That's how hard it used to be. And then Reagan just said, no, just make it easy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thus, as I've said many times, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very subtigalaniously ugly. The good, Saudi Arabia. Despite being the world's largest oil producer, Saudi Arabia is making huge strides in developing renewable energy. The country just revealed a plan to source 41,000 megawatts of solar projects over the next 20 years, which would create a domestic solar industry able to support one-third of total electricity production by 2032. This new plan is part of a larger goal of the country to increase sources of renewable energy and reduce oil consumption. Saudi Arabian oil minister said that societal expectations on climate change are real, and our industry is expected to take a leadership role. Maybe one day America's big oil executives will start to feel the same way. I'm not holding my breath, but maybe. The bad. Representative James Lankford. According to Representative Lankford, LGBT workers should not be protected from workplace discrimination because homosexuality is something that can be changed by Marcus Bachmann. When asked by Think Progress reporters if he thought a person could be born gay, Lankford replied, "Do I personally? No, I don't think it's a choice issue." Apparently, Lankford is unaware that the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and countless other accredited groups have concluded that homosexuality is not a choice. Members of the LGBT community have just as much a right to be respected in the workplace as anyone else. And Representative Lankford needs to realize that. And the very, very ugly John Derbyshire. Derbyshire is a former National Review contributor who was fired last month for publishing a racist article. Well, he didn't learn his lesson. In a column for a white nationalist website, Derbyshire praised white supremacy and its contributions to the world. He said, quote, "White supremacy in the sense of a society in which key decisions are made by white Europeans is one of the better arrangements history has come up with," end quote. He went on to say, quote, "White Europeans have made a better job of running fair and stable societies than has any other group," end quote. Derbyshire's strong support for racism and white supremacy has no place in America today and is very, very ugly. That's pretty amazing. Dwayne. In Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, trade agreements are unconstitutional? Really?
Yeah, Tom, there's no, it's not in the Constitution. You think a president who is a constitutional scholar would know that. The NAFTA never got the 66 votes required to be a treaty. It didn't pass legally.
Well, that's because we didn't call it a treaty. We called it a trade agreement.
But there's no provision in the Constitution to pass agreements. It's not there. It would take even more to pass an agreement, being that you'd have to first have a constitutional amendment authorizing agreements, and then you could pass one.
Well, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, Sentence 3.
Yes.
Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
Yes, and it would do so with treaty.
No, it has the power. It doesn't say with a treaty. It says it has the power to regulate commerce. That's a direct. Well, that's a direct power. I find myself, defending the constitutionality of these trade agreements. But let me make it very clear: I don't think that they should be in place.
But just because it says they can do it there, they're limited by the other part of the Constitution that says that you pass laws for domestic and you pass treaties when you want to deal with international.
No, I don't think so. If you could point that out to me, I don't recall anything. You know, the only reference to treaties in the Constitution is that they shall supersede U.S. law.
And it also says it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate.
Yes, to pass a treaty.
And
yes.
You're saying that you want to just call it under the Commerce Clause, you can pass agreements.
I'm saying...
I would say that under Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, all rights not specifically granted to the U.S. government are withheld.
Well, you know,
states could pass agreements between each other. People could pass.
I wish you were right, Dwayne, and maybe you are. I don't pretend to know, but it's I know that some of the pieces of NAFTA, some of these trade agreements have been passed. I believe some pieces of them have been passed as treaties, but I think that most of them have simply been passed as laws. They've been, Congress shall have the right to regulate commerce with foreign nations.
That's what irritates me about calling them treaties. Is if NAFTA?
Well, they don't. They call them trade agreements.
Treaty, I'd say fine. Call it if you want to. But NAFTA was never passed as a treaty, and I would consider it giving aid and comfort to the corporate destroyers of the American Republic.
Okay, I stand corrected. Thank you, Dwayne, for the call. Randall in Skokie, Illinois. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hi, hey Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate all that you do to educate the American people. A few callers ago, you were talking about privatization of certain
water supplies and things. Yeah, the commons.
Exactly, and it just so happened that last week my home flooded, and so I have a straight experience with that. I had the flood control, the plumber come out, who is of course working for a private company. And the disaster that would happen if we privatized the commons in this case, I live near Chicago and it's Chicago Reclamation District that handles that. And they have their issues because they're a government board and stuff like that. However, if it was private, I'd be greeted with a flood every year. The private company would tell me, that's the best we could do. And
they make money off it.
Exactly. And actually, the Republicans have grabbed, they're great at grabbing these power words like pro-life and right to work and stuff like that. And I think in this case, they screwed up because, the words should be profitize rather than privatize.
Yeah.
These operations and just call it what it is. You guys want more profit floating into the system. And actually, I think it may have been your show that coined the word back about right to work, about meaning that it's
right to work for less. Yeah. And we've talked about using profitize instead of privatize. But it's an excellent point, Randall. Thank you for calling and making it. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
There was a guy a little while back who was saying that we shouldn't follow Keynesian theory because some of our products are made in China.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that trade is a completely separate issue from economic theory.
I agree.
Just because some of the money does end up in China, the vast majority of the money that goes to middle-class people stays in the economy, and it actually has a multiplier effect. Whereas if you
it does, but it but that people, in absent a good trade policy, a made in USA policy, eventually most of that money ends up offshore. But you're right. There is a difference between the two. And thank you for calling and pointing it out. I appreciate it. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. It's been driving me crazy that the Republicans are using Solyndra as a club to beat Obama.
Are they still doing that? It's over on Fox News all day.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that name in the real news in a long, long time.
It's in commercials. I've seen a couple commercials where they use it to beat him up with.
I don't watch enough TV.
In the same country, we invested $500 million in Solyndra. They built two state-of-the-art factories. In Sweden or China or any other country, they would have just taken over the factories and then taken the products, all the solar panels, for the next 5 years. The United States government has 90,000 buildings. You could have covered those buildings, probably about 3,000 of those buildings, with the solar panels from Solyndra in about 4 years.
Sure.
In 10 years, the $500 million would have been paid back. And then the panels will last 30 years, so then you got free electricity all that time. But the Republicans have made renewable energy an enemy.
Did you see the memo that was leaked from this group that is putting together this anti-wind power group about how they're going to start this campaign to change people's perception of wind power and turn it negative so that people will think that wind power is a horrible thing and, you know,
it's fueled
by the fossil fuel industry, you know?
It's insane because they know it's going to work. The technology has matured to the point where it is viable, very viable. It would put millions of people to work. You know, I mean, we had a change in the 80s and 90s of going from analog electronics to digital, switching to the computer, and we put 40 million people to work, 20 million under Reagan, 20 million under Clinton. And we could do the same thing with renewable energy.
Yep.
It would be this huge boom. It would pay for itself.
Yep. Yep. And it is not going to happen as long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate. And there's, you know, and they're trying to take down a Democratic president. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Minneapolis, we've got a minute to the break. Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Earlier you were talking about Greece and dropping out of the euro with their debt, and then you talked about Argentina dropping out. And I know there's a really simplified analogy, but it seems like you advocated somebody taking a credit card, buying the things that they feel like they deserve, and then when they're expected to pay back the credit card, they just go file bankruptcy and go get another credit card. Because,
no, it's a very perfect analogy. I am
when
suggesting.
I do austerity on myself, you know, I eat ramen noodles and I don't go to the bar.
I don't think that you can draw a parallel between individual human families and governments. What I'm saying is that there is a clear case to be made that Goldman Sachs corrupted the government of Greece. And Matt Taibbi made it. It was a brilliant article that was first published in Rolling Stone magazine outing Goldman Sachs for helping Greece illegally, you know, to hide their debt so that they could get into the euro. And now they're stuck with it. And I don't think that the next generation should be stuck with the crimes that were committed by the politicians and the banksters of the previous generation. I think that Greece should, A, get out of the euro and go back to the drachma, and, B, they should be holding some of those politicians from a decade ago, you know, in court. That's my take on it, Chuck.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And not just the politicians, the banksters as well. Let's hold all of them accountable. We'll be back. 45 minutes past the hour.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard Cohen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just looking over the comments from the chat room. There's a lot going on there. Andrew in Beaumont, California, listening on Sirius. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Great.
Just got to tell you, I really appreciate, you know, what you're doing. I pick you up just as I'm driving home, and I don't get to listen to much of you. I usually get to listen about, you know, half an hour of what you're saying. I wish I had more time. Wish you were on a little later. But I'm a social science teacher. I teach history, and I teach government, and I teach economics. And you are 100% right. The trade agreements are constitutional because of what you point out at the Commerce Clause, that the government has the right to establish trade with foreign countries, and also because of the Necessary and Proper or Elastic Clause, which gives the Congress the power to do anything that they find necessary and proper to carry out the aforementioned duties.
Right.
So it's perfectly constitutional. The other man was wrong. You don't. The Senate only votes on treaties that deal with non-trade issues. It has nothing to do with trade issues. The Congress can pass a trade agreement whenever they want.
Okay.
They have that power.
By a simple majority.
Right, by a simple majority. They have that power. It's right in the Constitution. It's in the Commerce Clause. They have that power.
So they would equally have the power to blow up a trade agreement.
Right. They have equally the power. It's a law. So they can rescind the law as well as they can rescind any other law. Okay, so they can't, but it's perfectly constitutional. If it was unconstitutional, you bet your sweet bippy somebody would have brought it before the Supreme Court by now.
I would think so.
So it's constitutional.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
My other point is your other caller was talking about getting involved. This is something I tell my students as a government teacher all the time, that you can't sit back and complain about what's happening in this country if you aren't becoming aware and involved.
Yes. So, you in fact, I would even go so far as to say at a certain level, you forfeit your right to outrage if you don't participate.
Exactly. You really do. And that's one of the first questions I ask people when they go off on the government. It's like, do you vote?
Right.
And, you know, if the answer is no, then I stop talking to them. It's like, then I have no need to talk to you because you're not actually influencing my government at all. So your complaints are falling on deaf ears at this point.
Right. Or have you ever called a member of Congress, or have you ever, you know, fill in the blank?
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the assignments I have for my government students is they have to write their congressman with an issue that they're concerned about. They have to write them.
Good on you, Andy.
And they get responses from the congressman all the time.
Yeah, of course. Good on you. Thanks a lot for the call, Andrew, and thanks for the history lesson and the constitutional lesson. Much appreciated. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
How you doing today? Nothing much, but listen, this is it in a nutshell, and I'm so glad that you went back to Reagan because that's when it all started.
Yep.
We have the American public, we allow them to pervert capitalism and, in particular, rural white America and middle-class white America allowed them to pervert it to the point that if you talk against the government, you're okay. You're a real American. But if you talk against corporations, if you don't say they're people, then you are somehow un-American.
Yep.
And we let things like Glass-Steagall just go away without even noticing it, without even a whimper. Probably one of the biggest failure of the Republican Party was that right there. And until rural white America and middle class America wake up and stop giving their vote to people against their own self interest, we will always be on this roller coaster. And for the lack of,
you're right, Carl.
For God's sake, I don't understand how these people continuously give their vote to people that go and vote against them.
What the Republicans have been able to do is they have been able to convince people that the economic issues are not the important issues unless the economy is in real trouble, and then they've got a businessman who's going to solve everything. And then they create these coalitions with gun owners and homophobes and racists, and don't underestimate the number of those three groups in the United States. And they build this coalition of these fringe elements, and boom, you've got something that pretends to be a political party. I have a problem thinking of the Republican Party as even a legitimate political party, because it's really a front for corporate America, not even for corporate America, for transnational corporations. And it's a front that
have been for 30 years, and they've been continuously and you left out the xenophobes out there, too. So you got the homophobes, the xenophobes, and the racists all rolled in one, and they keep voting against their own self-interest. It is one of the more bizarre things. But the thing about it, the good thing about it, is that they're starting, even though there's been a big coalition over the past 30 years, they're starting to die out. That may sound a little grim, a little gruesome.
No, but you're right. You're right. That generation that bought that stuff is going away. The problem is that you got a new generation who's buying Ayn Rand's stuff coming up and Ron Paul's stuff. And they're just as badly confused. Carl, I want to get one last caller in here. Kathleen in Dixon, California. We have about a half a minute, Kathleen. You wanted to tell us a funny story?
Yes. I was shopping this weekend for my grandson, and I thought this fit in perfectly with what you were talking about, where the guards along the border, where their uniforms are made.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this little T-shirt that said, Made in the USA, on the front.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, what does that mean? Is that a proclamation of citizenship? So let's go see where it's made. And on the label, of course, it was made in Mexico.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, I can't find one thing for him made in the USA.
Yeah.
And that was just like too ironic when I heard you talking about
that. That is incredibly ironic. Kathleen, thanks for sharing that story with us. It's great. Made in the USA T-shirts are made in China or made in Mexico. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, we'll have a rumble with conservative Carrie Lucas of the Independent Women's Forum. If you stay home and raise children, shouldn't you be compensated? Don't moms deserve a social safety net, too? Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy begins when you participate, when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.